LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Beyond politics, poverty, and war. LegalizeFreedom.com.
As real, but not as brightly lit.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat, and today we present part two of our interview with Bernardo Kastrup discussing his latest book, Brief Peaks Beyond, critical essays on metaphysics, neuroscience, free will, skepticism, and culture. The interview resumes as we consider the tendency of materialistic science to dump many unexplained phenomena in a dustbin labelled anomalies, when, if examined from a broader perspective, some of these so-called anomalies could actually help solve some of the most mysterious puzzles in science.
When materialists are not naming things and claiming then more or less to explain them, or, you know, pretty soon, somewhere down the line, the guys at CERN are working on it, you know, just don't call us, we'll call you, you know, but that sort of thing. They're then writing things off as anomalies. You know, when they will concede something, they say, yeah, okay, yeah, that's observed effect, or we've seen that happen multiple times, or somebody ran a research thing on this, and yeah, okay, it's a thing, we don't know what it is. So they'll call them anomalies. And these anomalies just pile up as the materialistic explanation for reality becomes ever more bizarre and baroque, you know, and Byzantine. I'm thinking of, you know, like dark matter, like the Higgs boson. And these just things are stacking up. And sometimes, again, they're utterly, as we just mentioned, utterly, completely theoretical. And if you look at sort of the list of subatomic particles and you start to look at multiverse theory and 10 dimensions and string theory, this is stuff I think that people maybe reading popular science will think that either exists or has some basis in reality. Or again, you know, the guys in the lab coats are about to kind of come out with this. And it's bizarre because it's in this area of the anomalies where the interest lies, you know, and it's, but that's all being kind of put in a crate and put in a dark storage vault somewhere.
Yeah. But you see, we have always had, this is intrinsic, and I discussed this in the book as well. You probably read it. The human being has an intrinsic archetypal need to relate to transcendence, because deep in the obfuscated segments of our psyches, we are still in contact with our true origin, with our true ground of being, in mind at large. Deep in within, we still know that, and we have a self-reflective need to relate to that, to bring that into our ordinary awareness. That's an archetypal psychological need in every human being. And in the old days, this would be done, or this need would be fulfilled through the symbolism of religion, which of course was hijacked by literalists as something that was literally true, you know, and became fundamentalism. But this need to bring a transcendent aspect of reality that's obfuscated in our psyches into the light of ordinary awareness is there. And once religion is discarded, you have to replace that somehow, because the demand, the cultural demand, is there. And today it's being replaced with this very abstract speculations of physicists who are actually doing philosophy under the guide of physics, under the guise of physics. And that is the speculations about multiverses and all kinds of fundamentally inaccessible, mysterious things that are playing out, and which they link to empirical observation in a very, how to say, tenuous, very precarious way. There are many steps of abstraction between anything empirical and these grand speculations about parallel universes. But it just fulfills our archetypal need to relate to transcendence in a way that our intellects grant permission to be taken on board as possibly true. And before it was priests, now it's the new priesthood of physicists who are making these fantastic TV documentaries that we all love to watch and entertain in our dreaming minds.
When you say a priesthood of scientists, I'm reminded of, again, these sort of things just pop into my head randomly, but the old movie Beneath the Planet of the Apes. And again, in the far future, you know, I'm sure you know the scenario, Earth ruled by advanced apes, and but there's still some humans there, but they live in an underworld in a cave system. And they're the descendants of scientists, the ones that originally developed nuclear weapons, which ultimately, you know, caused so much havoc in the Earth and led to the rise of the apes. And they have the remainder of their atomic bombs in this underground cavern, and they worship them. They've kind of lost sight of what science was, and it's actually transmuted into pure religion. And the bombs are there. They're wearing white, I seem to remember white robes or something, but there's still something scientific looking about it. And they're, oh mighty bomb, and you know.
I'm not complete. I understand your metaphor, and I think there's a lot of truth in it. At the same time, and just not to sell myself too short or not to misrepresent what my actual position is, I feel the need to make this disclaimer, explain this caveat. I am not completely negative about this. So let me explain you why. I think there is a role for science and there is a role for philosophy. Both are very important. Science explains to us and allows us to model the visible patterns and regularities of nature so we can predict future events. That is the basis for technology. Without our ability to model and predict the patterns and regularities of nature, we can't build technology. And technology is important, let's be frank. It allows us to live longer, more comfortable lives, allows us to have this conversation that we are having right now and share ideas, share feelings, and relate to each other more. On the other hand, you have philosophy, which interprets the models of science and gives them ontological meaning. It's something that allows us to have ideas regarding the underlying nature of reality, what reality is, as opposed to how it will behave. Science only tells us how things will behave, not what they intrinsically are. Science is fundamentally incapable of telling us what things fundamentally are. Only their behavior can be modeled. We have known this since Russell, early in the 20th century. So philosophy is important to give meaning to our lives, to allow us to recognize ourselves, to find our place in nature, in life, to relate to the world, to relate to our own obfuscated minds, and to each other. The problem we see today is that a lot of philosophy is being done under the guise of science in order to hijack the legitimacy science has gained as the enabler of technology. And we start projecting, we start mixing things up. We start thinking that scientists can tell us about the ultimate nature of reality. They can't. Their tools, their methodology does not allow them to do that. Only the tools and methodologies of philosophy do. And then scientists start doing philosophy without having any equipment, any tools, any preparation, any education to do it. And the result is catastrophic. It ends up in the philosophy metaphysics of materialism. But some of the stuff scientists are doing is philosophy and is good. I'll take some heat on this from some of my physicist friends. I used to work at CERN, by the way. I think, for instance, that M-theory, although it's a philosophy, a mathematical philosophy, not a science, it is important, and it is showing the way to something very critical. M-theory is telling us that all nature, all observable phenomena, can be modeled as excitations or vibrations of what they would call a hyperdimensional membrane, which is a theoretical entity. They don't tell you what the fundamental nature of this membrane is. They just say, well, there exists some kind of membrane, and when it vibrates and gets excited, out pop atoms, out pop energy fields, forces, out pops the universe as we know it. So the entire universe is actually excitation, patterns of excitation of this hyperdimensional membrane. What I would say is, this membrane is consciousness. The entire world is a pattern of excitations of consciousness. What we see when we look out is the outside view, is the pattern of excitations of processes in consciousness that are outside our particular dissociated altar of mind at large. The way psychic processes in mind at large appear to us as dissociated alters is the world we see around us, the empirical world, which can be modeled as excitations of this membrane. The membrane, in my view, being mind at large itself. So I'm not totally pessimistic about the philosophical things that are coming down the pike in physics. I just regret that they are taken, one, to be science, and two, that science is taken to be a means to inform us about the nature of reality. It isn't. It's a means to predict the behavior of reality.
Oh, I mean, totally agreed on that philosophical point. And of course, we've all benefited to a greater or lesser extent from science and subsequently technology. With the whole Planet of the Apes things, I was just having a bit of fun because I was fast forwarding into the potential future and, you know, some of the challenges that we face and how society will necessarily change in coming generations. And just wondering about if science has, you know, will its role in society change if it isn't tied in with technology, you know, in that material sense? You're talking about the philosophical aspects of science. I'm just wondering where science might end up, if you see what I mean, the role for scientists. Now, it's all so important, you know, like, for example, you look at the breathless reporting of the activities at CERN, and I've watched entire TV shows about it, entire radio specials. There was one guy, can't remember who he was, but a British media personality, and there was a whole radio show made about him walking around CERN, you know, doing a circuit of the whole facility. And they turned that into a show, and he wasn't a scientist. He wasn't even particularly interested. He just thought it'd be interesting. The BBC would send him to walk around, and, you know, so the science is just at the center of everything, because it's perceived as delivering all our technology. So I was just having a bit of fanciful speculation about the role of science and indeed, you know, religion 100, 200 years from now.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, what we projected onto religion before, the inner values, the numinosity of the deep layer of our, layers of our psyche that we projected onto religion, we are projecting onto science now because the archetypal need to relate to transcendence is still there. Personally, I think science will always remain important. It's an extremely powerful method. I have been a scientist, by the way, for many years. It's an extremely powerful method to honestly observe and model the patterns and regularities of nature to allow us to predict the behavior of nature. That role will always be there, and science has a long way to go before it becomes irrelevant, if it will ever become irrelevant in this sense. The problem and the great tragedy I see is what I mentioned to you. We are projecting numinous value onto science, while science is basically a utilitarian methodology. It has a utility, which is to create technology. It is not there. It's not equipped to inform us about the ultimate nature of reality and the ultimate nature of ourselves, of who or what we are. And by projecting numinosity onto science, we expect scientists to give us these answers about the nature of reality and the nature of ourselves, which we will not find there. But scientists, once they receive the projection, there's this process which in psychology is called inflation. You think you're bigger and more important and more knowledgeable than you are. They will try to give you the answers. Once you put a Stephen Hawking on a pedestal as the smartest man on earth, he will give you all the answers to all questions you're asking. And most people will believe in them, even though, in my opinion, many of those answers are complete crap. They're total nonsense. And that's the tragedy. So I think science will always be there, but we should be careful not to mix up science with philosophy. Philosophy has an important role to play. Philosophy can leverage more data, more avenues of investigation than science. For instance, introspection. It's something that belongs in philosophy. Science is about measurement. And when you talk about the ultimate nature of reality and the ultimate nature of ourselves, the data from introspection is crucial because we cannot extricate ourselves from reality. Reality unfolds in our consciousness. We are the carriers of reality. We cannot extricate ourselves from that analysis. So philosophy and introspection are critical to give you the proper answers there. And that's where things are breaking down today completely.
Yeah, to an extent, we do the same thing with politicians, I think, in the sense that in looking for meaning outside of ourselves, despite the widespread cynicism about politics and politicians now, we're always looking somewhere else. And we, you know, give in the case of politicians, we give them the idea, or certainly have for a long time, that they should be something more than administrators. And politicians come out and they announce that they have, I don't know what it's like in the Netherlands, but they're always announcing here that they've got a vision for Britain. And if any politician says he's got a vision for your country, your life, he's just run a mile.
Yeah. And what you alluded to, this need to project things out, right? It's so prevalent in our culture.
Yeah.
We're always looking for meaning outside. And I've been writing about this recently, actually. You know, when your parents tell you for the first time in your infancy, after you have a nightmare and you wake up sweaty and nervous in the middle of the night, and then your parents come to you and they say, "Don't you worry, it was just a nightmare. It was just a dream." That's the inception of this break, of this rift that goes right across our psyche. From that point on, things are either outside and alien, or inside ours, but negligible and unimportant. It was just a dream. A dream is an unfolding of your psyche. It is the expression of what you are. When you are told it's just a dream, basically you are being told that you don't matter, that the only thing that matters is that giant outside world that is alien. It isn't you, but it's the only important thing. So all the importance we give to our experiences becomes focused on the so-called outside, the shared aspects of reality. The psychic process is unfolding outside the altar, the dissociated altar. And then once we get that encoded in our heads, we have to project everything. And that may lie at the inception of materialism. You see, we project ourselves onto matter. We are projecting consciousness onto matter. We are basically saying that the essence of what it means to be us is outside us. It's on this postulate, this inference, this abstract creation of ourselves, which is matter outside consciousness.
You're touching upon dreams there. I mean, some of the most powerful experiences I've ever had in my life have been while asleep. And I never understood that point where, I mean, I think again, as a child having a nightmare and being told it wasn't real, I thought to myself, in what sense wasn't it real? I mean, it took place in some, you know, in my inner self. But it felt pretty damn real at the time when I was being attacked by a werewolf or whatever it happened to be. You know what I mean? And if you wake from something like that, if you have an emotional experience in your dream, then that is certainly real. And I've had some dreams that I awoke from, you know, not unpleasant ones, but just staggered, just shattered for a whole day afterwards, just going, wow, just thinking back on what happened. And it did happen.
Yeah. You know, I think the ideal thing for parents to say to children in a situation like this is not that it was just a dream, therefore it wasn't real, but to say, oh, it was real, all right, but it can't hurt you because it was you. It was not outside you. You can't hurt yourself. These are experiences unfolding within you. It was real, real as anything else, because anything else is an experience as well. And everything is real as such, as experiences, but it can't hurt you. So it's all right. Now, notice that the same thing can be said of reality at large. It's real, all right. These are shared experiences. And a truck can come and hit you and flatten you and you will die. It's real. But it really can't destroy you because it only means your dissociated complex of mind at large will reintegrate. If biology is the image of dissociation, the end of biology is the end of dissociation. It's just like waking up from a dream when you become dissociated as a dream character. Once you wake up, you realize that you weren't a character inside a dream, that you were the whole dream. You were making up the whole thing. The dissociation ends and you go like, oh, okay, that's what was going on. I forgot for a moment I was dissociated. I think that would be better. And you see, we come back to that naive materialist notion of what it means for something to be true. First, they infer this abstract world outside consciousness, and then they link truth to it, not to experience itself. So if you have a private experience, like in a dream, which can't be linked to the abstract world outside consciousness, then it is untrue. I would say that this is the so-called correspondence theory of truth in philosophy. I would say it's a completely flawed theory because it depends on an unprovable, unnecessary abstraction, namely the world outside consciousness. I would think that a much more useful definition for what we are trying to grab a hold of when we talk about truth under materialism is to distinguish experiences between collective shared ones on the one hand and individual idiosyncratic ones on the other hand. That's the differentiation we are looking for when you talk about truth, usually. Everything is true in the sense that everything is an experience, but some experiences are not shared, and it's important to make that distinction. I may hallucinate a dragon landing on my backyard next minute, but if I now go on TV and I claim that a dragon really landed on my backyard, what I will be claiming is that was a shared experience, that my neighbors should have seen that, that there should be footprints on my backyard if anybody were to go there now and look at it. So the mistake I'm making is to attribute to the collective an experience that was individual. And that's the mistake we should avoid. Because if we don't make that differentiation, then you will get a tyrant who will rule the world according to his own idiosyncratic view of reality, which the rest of us may not share, but we have to comply to. And that's a tremendous risk. We have to avoid that. I'm not promoting relativism. I'm not promoting the idea that everybody's report or everybody's opinion about what's going on is equally valid. I'm not saying that. And please don't get me wrong on this. All I'm saying is that the criteria for differentiation is not correspondence to this naive inferred world outside consciousness, but whether an experience is shared or not.
Well, thinking about quality of experience, if I think back to life 30 years ago or even 20 years ago, sometimes that feels like a dream in terms of quality. And I think of what I recall a dream that I had, last week, for example, and I think back to, the 1980s. It's kind of like, it seems so loose and, I can't really find the words for it. Do you know what I'm getting at, though?
Yeah, I've been writing about this as well recently, Greg. If you're really, I was not planning to get into this, but I will, because I feel there's a momentum here. If you're really strict and really self-honest about what you can know and what you are making up, you come to the following conclusion. The past is an idea in your head. It's fragmented memories and a storyline to connect these fragments of memory together. And that storyline is something you invent yourself. The future is an expectation in your mind. I said in your head, I meant your mind. The future is an expectation in your mind. It's a story you're creating in your own mind. You only really have the present. But what's the present? Is the present today and yesterday the past and tomorrow the future? Well, what about the present being this hour, because then last hour is the past, and the next hour is the future. But wait a moment. Next second is the future, and last second was the past. Only this second is the present. Or is it? And if you go on down this line of thought, chipping away at the present, you end up with a Planck time. And a Planck time is an unimaginably small, tiny peasant little hairline of time that is much, much, much smaller than anything you can reasonably conceive based on our usual references of time. And that immediately leads us to the conclusion that the bulk of our experience must be mental. Even if you're a materialist, even under the assumptions and postulates and inference of materialism, the vast, vast majority, 99.99999999, a long time percent of your experiences is mental, is in consciousness, in the form of memories and interpolated storylines for the past and expectations about the future. The present is a kind of little cognitive singularity, a little cognitive volcano spilling out symbols that seems to coordinate the experiences of multiple people. But it's so ephemeral. It's almost abstract. It's like a true singularity in the sense that it's infinitesimally small.
I think you've just reminded me of something that I failed to remember a couple of weeks ago in an interview, which is what I once had Fred Alan Wolfe on, and I was talking about the past, you know, the nature of time and the past and future didn't exist. And he said, and I'll tell you something else, there's no present moment. So I think what you're talking about must have been what he was getting at, because I remember...
Yes. There is no time. Time is a story confabulated in consciousness. But okay, that goes far. I'm not ready yet to go into all this. I'm leaving this for next year.
Well, before we leave the dream thing, I was tickled by your recollection in the book about the dream that you had that sort of bled in with, well, I was going to use the word reality. We have to be careful what we mean by that, but you were asleep and some rainwater dripped onto your feet. That was a great little story.
Yeah, I related that to my UFO theory, so to say. I was on holidays abroad, and I was sleeping in a hotel, and the windows were open. It was very hot, and I started dreaming, and in the middle of the night, there was a storm, and rain was flooding into the room and wetting my feet. But I was still dreaming, and I was dreaming I was walking on the beach, and my feet were under the surf, and I was dragging my feet in the water. And the feeling of the actual wetness of my feet in bed merged seamlessly with the feeling of wetness of dragging my feet in the surf. And the reason I told that story is that it illustrates how two frames of reality, in this case a dream and the so-called real reality, they can overlap. And when they overlap, certain elements from one frame of reality, in this case the rain on my feet, merge into the storyline of another frame of reality, namely the feeling of wetness of my feet being dragged in the surf. They merge seamlessly into it. They acquire a different shape, surf, instead of raindrops. They acquire a different shape, but the essential aspect of that thing is preserved, namely the feeling of wetness. So I was speculating in the book that if reality is a collective dream, a shared dream, and we are just dissociated alters within the dream, there might be many dreams going on in mind at large. There may be dissociated meta-alters, of which we are alters, and then meta-meta-alters, and so on and so forth. Each one of those levels having a sort of collective dream experienced by many alters that populate it. And if that is the case, if these dreams overlap, you would have a similar effect. You would have an intrusion into our collective dream that we call our reality, of elements from another reality or another dream that would then be hijacked by the codes, symbols, and references of our reality. They would be dressed up with references that we can make sense of, like I dressed up the rain on my feet with the surf on the beach of my dream. And that may be what's going on in the cases of UFO abduction or alien abductions and UFO reports. It may be an intrusion of another dream, another reality into ours, which we then dress up according to references we can understand, like humanoid beings with large heads and no hair, which is just the evolutionary line. If you look back at our evolutionary history as primates and you extrapolate this forward, you get to what an alien looks like, and spaceships, which are our cultural references of since the 20th century. Before that, it was balloons or flying shields, and you see UFO reports using all those references if you read Jacques Vallée's most recent book from 2010. So I was speculating that all that phenomenology may be is this overlapping, this protrusion of another dream, another dissociated meta-alter of mind at large into ours, leading to this mix-up of realities and this plethora of metaphors that people use to describe the phenomenon.
And that reminds me, you think of all the chariots of fire and fire in the sky and, you know, wheels of fire and all that stuff going back thousands of years that people supposedly witnessed.
Sure. I mean, Alexander the Great and his army are supposed to have witnessed two UFOs, I believe, in the form of flying shields. What was their reference at the time as warriors? Shields and swords. So they saw flying shields. If you go back to the Bible, you see people describing chariots with four wheels, like Ezekiel's vision. Chariots and wooden wheels with spokes were the references Ezekiel had. Today our references are spaceships and big-headed humanoid beings. So that's the language we use to describe it. And we also have reference about surgical procedures, which people didn't have in the past. In the past, there would be trees poking out of somebody's head and you know, things like this. Now, as Whitley Strieber made famous, it's probing, bodily, intrusive bodily probing, surgical procedures. So the references change, just like it would change if I was having another dream that night. If I were, for instance, instead of walking on the surf on a beach, if I were under a waterfall, I'm sure I would have registered the rain on my feet as the splashes of water in the waterfall. It would have gained another reference. It would be explained in another way. But the essential intrinsic nature of the thing, namely the wetness of water, is preserved. So what I'm saying is that although UFO experiences and alien abduction experiences are described in such contradictory ways by the use of different symbols, metaphors, and cultural references, the underlying essence is probably preserved, and we can do a study to detect what is the underlying element that is always present beneath the actual physical descriptions. And I think you would find that that underlying element is actually true.
I don't recall ever really having many conversations in dreams, but I do remember one in particular where someone who I know but haven't seen for a long time kind of walked up to me and I said, what are you doing here? And they said, I have dreams as well. And I don't remember anything else about it, but it was so real. It was, I can't remember. I can say I woke up shortly afterwards, but I can't say that for sure. It could have been 10 hours later. Do you know what I mean? That's just the nature of dreams. But that was so striking. It was like, it felt more real than real, if I'm honest.
Absolutely. I mean, Henri Corbin, who was a professor of religious studies at Sorbonne in Paris, an expert in Islamic esoteric traditions, he wrote about the mundus imaginalis. And what he said was that our imagination is not only an organ of confabulation for creating fantasies, idiosyncratic fantasies, it is also an organ of perception that through what Jung called but through the use of the imagination, if you allow it to become autonomous as opposed to being under the control of the ego, you can actually perceive an inner world, a symbolic inner world in which inner truths are expressed through symbolism, and that symbolism may conveniently hijack images from your waking life, depending on what's most evocative to you emotionally. So different people may have different symbols when they are accessing the mundus imaginalis. But the key point of Corbin's description is that the mundus imaginalis is an actual reality, is an autonomous reality of our psyches, to some extent individual, to some extent collective as well, which we perceive through the imagination, active imagination. That's the expression I was looking for that Jung used, that we perceive through our active imagination when we allow the imagination to run autonomously as opposed to being coordinated by our egoic volition.
Just to take a change in direction, you also pointed out that the materialist creed can quite often contain inaccuracies when, you know, examined closely, but as long as the headline and basically the main bullet points sort of bear out what supposedly is the consensus, it's kind of let go, because, you know, who's fact checking? You've got this peer review situation, you know, where there's a bit of a closed shop in some disciplines as far as I can see. And I think that in many ways, the mainstream media are enablers in this, because I listen to popular science reporting and it tends to be, you know, our science correspondent, they'll come on the BBC and I don't know what research they've done. I don't know what they actually know about their particular subject area. You'd like to think they'd be fairly well informed, but they tend to regurgitate the press release and it's presented in a certain way. And I've certainly heard things on the mainstream media where I thought to myself, well, my understanding from what I've looked into and eminent people that I've spoken with, that is not the case. But this bang, there it is, going out to millions of people by their respected science correspondents. And it's inaccurate.
It's rampant, what you're describing. It happens all the time. Even if we leave the peer review process alone, and there are many problems with it, many problems that have been very recently highlighted. Many papers have been pulled out of important publications recently. There are some scandals about paid peer review and some, well, even if we leave all of that aside, and even if we assume that the peer review process goes smoothly and as well as it can go, we are still left with the problem you described at the end, which is, the mainstream media, in their role of having to digest and make those scientific conclusions understandable, often they will completely distort the meaning and implications of what has been found. And if you go to the scientific paper, you realize that, hey, this is nothing here at all. The conclusions that are being hyped by the mainstream media are not there at all. There is a tenuous semantic link, which clearly was what motivated the hype. But if you really go strictly into it, it's completely unjustifiable what people made out of those conclusions. And I'll highlight one example. There was a study done not many years ago about memory and the headlines, and this is not even non-scientific media. This was even the website of the university where the study was conducted, if I remember correctly. I may be wrong about this, but that's what I seem to recall now. They basically promoted the study as having found where physical memory traces are stored in the brain. That would have been revolutionary if it were the case, and that's how it was hyped back then. But if you go to the scientific paper, all the researchers found was that the same neurons get activated during the original experience and the subjective recall of the experience. The same neurons. Now, that's no surprise at all. We know that experiences correlate with certain patterns of neuronal activation. When you have an experience and then you recall it, the recall is subjectively very similar to the original experience. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a recall, it would be confabulation. That the same neurons turn on again during recall is no surprise at all. The question is, how does the brain know which neurons to turn on during the recall? Where is that information stored? And the paper said nothing at all about it. It didn't answer an iota of the fundamental question of where memory is in the brain. But it was hyped as having finally found the answer. And now we can all go home happy and satisfied. Materialism is correct. Memories are indeed physical traces in the brain. Nonsense! This was not at all in the paper, and it was hyped as such. And this happens all the time. In the book I describe several examples of this. There are examples in psychedelic research, which has been showing that fantastic psychedelic experiences, very intense and rich on a subjective level, are correlated with dramatic reductions in brain activity and no increase anywhere. And even the people who arrived at this conclusion at first now are basically saying that, well, there are some increases in activity in certain dream-related areas, but if you drill down to the papers, what they actually found is that there is an increase in the variation of activity. Not in metabolism, not in brain activity itself, which has never been found to increase, only to decrease. And yet it's hyped by the media, and even the researchers themselves seem to be conducive to this, as if finally an increase in brain activity was found. So, hey, materialism is consistent with these measurements, because according to materialism, an experience that is increased in richness and intensity has to correlate with an increase in brain activity somewhere in the brain, which was not the case found before. But now they found it, right? So materialism is consistent with it again. Hey, guess what? Not at all. They found only that activity variability increases. In other words, processes in the brain turn on and off more frequently, but the global level activity has not been found to increase. So you see, so long as the misinterpretation, so long as the misrepresentation seems to be consistent and reinforce materialism, it's incredibly easy to get away with dramatic mistakes. And then people read these papers or this media digests superficially, and they go home with the impression that materialism is being reinforced and confirmed all over the place in science. That's not the case. That is simply not the case. And you can't even blame people, because how many people have the scientific background that I and few other people have to go to the actual sources that even have subscriptions to these papers, because most of the times you have to pay $35 for each of these papers, and I happen to have subscriptions, and download them and have the background to read them and actually see what has been found, actually see what has been concluded, and realize that it doesn't reinforce materialism at all. Often it even contradicts materialism directly. So we are living in a culture of make-believe. We are living a story, a make-believe story in which materialism is being confirmed by science. That's totally untrue. It's incredible what the media can get away with if only it errs on the side of materialism.
Well, we're talking about popular science. I think it's quite telling that what your average guy and girl in the street tends to be interested in and what scientists emphasize are quite different. I mean, even Richard Dawkins, I mean, he really does get a hard time here. I must admit, we're always kicking his ass, but poor guy. No, if you're out there, Richard, you know, hey, everything's great. But the nuts and bolts of it all, talking about subatomic particles and, you know, all the latest research, whatever it happens to be, or the latest philosophical speculation even, tends to be the domain of the of scientists, and what average people tend to be interested in are the implications or the potential implications. You know, some of the things that you get into, and it's like, okay, well, that's that, and you say that's that, but what does this mean? And I think that's very important in terms of what you talked about earlier, in terms of what we're projecting onto science now. We're saying, what does this mean? What does this mean for me? What does this say about who we are? You know, how we got here, and you know, are there any answers in there?
Of course, but you see, science needs to be funded. Scientists have jobs; they get paid salaries. Me too. I used to be a scientist for several years, and we only get our salaries and our funding to do our research if what we do, in some way, to some extent, resonates with what people find important. Science is often funded by governments. Some more and more, it's being funded by private companies. But okay, that's a different phenomenon. Basic science is still majority funded by governments, like CERN, for instance, which get billions of euros in funding. If what they do cannot be translated into something that resonates with what the people at large find important, their funding will dry, their careers will stop, they will not get their salaries, and there will not be future scientists being trained. So there is a massive effort happening to translate scientific results into things that people can relate to. And in that process, things go dramatically wrong. In one sense, it's what we just discussed, how the media translates that in order to have popular appeal. It usually completely distorts what the conclusion was. There was a paper recently published, I think, on the Mayo Online, reporting that, there is an explanation for out-of-body experiences coming out of science. And if you look at the paper, nobody in that research ever had an out-of-body experience. They were just fitted with video headsets with images acquired by a camera in somebody else's head, so they had the impression that they were in somebody else's body, I mean. So it simulated an out-of-body experience, and then they measured some brain activity that was not ordinary. Of course not. You put somebody with a video headset, completely unnatural thing, feeding images that were acquired from somebody else's point of view, and you don't want anything to change in the person's brain, in the person's sense of location, of course it will change. The whole thing is induced artificially. Nobody had a real out-of-body experience in that study, and yet it's promoted as an explanation for out-of-body experiences. I mean, it's dramatically misleading, almost criminally so, if you ask me. That's my personal opinion, and I'm entitled to one. So in this process of translation to mobilize enthusiasm and interest from the people, things are terribly misrepresented. That's one thing that happens. And there is another aspect of the phenomenon that I just lost from my train of thought, now. But it is this. The other aspect was scientists becoming philosophers instead of maintaining scientific prudence in saying, "Hey, we are just modeling the behavior of things here, and we can empirically validate our models because that's what nature tells us. If you predict it wrong, I would tell you." That it's wrong, Mr. Scientist. That's nature talking to the scientist. This is what science is, an ability to predict, to model and predict the patterns and regularities of nature. But for most people, this doesn't matter. This is just a tool, a utility to create technology. People are interested in the implications, in the intrinsic nature of self and reality, and then to continue to be relevant in the culture and society, scientists will start put on the hat of philosophers. But most of the times they are terrible at it. They are not aware of their own cognitive processes because they lack profoundly in any ability of introspection. So they are not aware of the implicit ontological, metaphysical assumptions they are making. They are not aware of all the things they are implicitly assuming and taking for granted. They are not aware of their own cognitive processes. And they make terrible philosophy. They create a sham. And that's where things go wrong too. So what you just described may be the key motivation behind two important problems in the culture and society today.
One thing I take a great interest in is so-called transhumanism and posthumanism. And you mentioned that you'd done some work, I don't believe I knew this fact before, with artificial intelligence. And I follow these developments keenly. And the reason is this. Because these attempts to model consciousness, to create genuinely intelligent, you know, artificial consciousness, to get a computer that we can somehow interact with in a way that we can't distinguish from that another human being. I'm interested that they keep coming up against basic limitations. And I think that beyond the Ray Kurzweil type ideas, some of which I think are absolutely crackpot, this is an area of interesting research, but I don't think that the people who've got high hopes for it are going to have their hopes delivered. You know, there was that recent, you can maybe remember this better than me, there was a something threshold that was crossed apparently with that computer, intelligent computer somewhere in the Eastern Bloc. Struggling to remember this because, again, it's not scripted here. I'm just going with whatever comes up. And there was another computer system, which I saw online recently, and it featured a woman's head. And there was somebody was having a
Ramona.
Yeah, having a conversation there. And the questions were like, you know, they're just absolutely inane. If you ask these questions to a 3-year-old school kid, you get called patronizing. And where I'm coming from on this, I say, what I wanted to do was get in front of that machine and say, I love you. And it's okay. What's the response going to be? Or do you think you'll ever be able to fall in love? Or, Did you see the sunset yesterday? You know, what do you feel when you look at the sunset? Just questions like that. And I think there's a fundamental misunderstanding of consciousness. And I think that some of the people doing this sort of research are slowly discovering that.
The amount of misunderstanding and prejudice in there is just unbelievable. Let's try to make sense of this step by step. Step one. Artificial consciousness is one thing. Artificial intelligence is another thing. And that most researchers confuse the two. And it's puzzling why. You see, a machine that is intelligent is a machine that can interact with its environment in a way that we as external observers can judge to be intelligent. In other words, the machine has an internal model of the world and interacts with the environment in that model in a sophisticated and coherent enough way that we, from the outside, say, hey, that's an intelligent machine. A machine that is so can even pass the Turing test, which was made famous by that movie Ex Machina. Now, to do this, an intelligent machine performs all kinds of internal calculations. But those calculations do not need to be accompanied by subjective experience. The machine doesn't need to experience those calculations. They can all happen completely in the dark. So an intelligent machine can be, and probably will be, just a glorified calculator, a very complex calculator that manifests external behaviors that are coherent, that we, as external observers, judge as intelligent. That's all. An intelligent machine, even human-level intelligence, even transhuman-level intelligence, does not need to be conscious. And there is no reason to believe it will be. Because, you see, to believe that a simulation of information flow in a computer, a simulation of the human information flow in the brain taking place within a computer, to believe that that will also be conscious like we are, is akin to believing that a simulation of chemical reactions in a kidney running on my computer on my desk right now will cause my computer to pee on my desk. A simulation is not the phenomenon. That's why we call it a simulation. It's not the phenomenon. I can simulate kidney function in my computer and my computer will not pee on my desk. I can simulate information flow in somebody's brain in my computer and my computer will not be conscious. Consciousness is the inside perspective of what's going on. Intelligence is the outside perspective. I can judge intelligence from the outside. I cannot tell whether a computer is conscious short of becoming the computer. Only then will I know whether there is something, anything it is like to be the computer. And since we can't become the computer, we cannot know that it's conscious. And then the next question is, do we have any reason to believe that it will be conscious? None whatsoever, for the same reason that I don't have reason to believe that my computer will pee on my desk if it's simulating kidney function. You see, I believe what we call human consciousness, as I mentioned earlier, is not something that is created by the brain. In that sense, there is no point in talking about artificial consciousness. Consciousness is the ground of reality. It's what there is. It's the brain of M-theory, the excitations of which are reality. You can't create it because it's the framework within which creation happens. All creations happen within consciousness. You can't create consciousness. It's the ground of existence. So what do we mean when we say we want to create a conscious machine? What we actually mean is we want to create a dissociated altar of mind at large, a dissociated altar of cosmic consciousness, in the words of Maurice Buck or Deepak Chopra. That's what we are looking for, to induce a dissociation in this universal consciousness. Because that's what we are. We are dissociated alters of this universal consciousness. Now, the only image we know of this process of dissociation is biology, life, metabolism. So if we want to create artificially a dissociated alter of mind at large, I would say, let's try to create life from non-life. Let's try to create metabolism from non-metabolizing matter. That's the way to go. That's the path to pursue. In other words, technically, this is called abiogenesis, the creation of life from non-life. Nobody ever succeeded in doing this. It's one of the greatest mysteries in science. But I would say that the search for artificial consciousness is one and the same, in my view, with the search for abiogenesis. And to expect that we will create a conscious entity by simulating information flow in a computer is as absurd as to expect that my computer will pee because I simulate kidney processing in it.
Well, just as we begin to draw things to a close for today, Bernardo, I just want to kind of round off by touching on topic that we had right at the beginning, which is, you know, where all this is going, and in terms of the materialistic worldview being tied up with the industrial economy. And we collectively, more or less in different parts of the world, we do seem to be suffering from a sort of poverty of the psyche, like a sort of existential emptiness. We have the aforementioned effect of materialism on the real world and the negative effects that we're seeing there. And still we're increasingly asking the question, you know, what's this for? The answer that nothing really, which materialism offers, is increasingly unacceptable. It's certainly not TV dinners and American Idol, plastic crap that we don't need coming out of sweatshops. So, yeah. But we're making a transition here, whether we like it or not, whether you've got a materialistic worldview, a religious fundamentalist one, or something in between, things are clearly changing even as we speak, and they'll continue to do so. And the question is, what happens when we stop buying so much stuff and look elsewhere, perhaps look inward? And you give the opinion in the book that
And I agree with you, actually, that it's probably going to be a bumpy ride because of the entrenched forces and the vested interests here.
Yeah, you know, history is made by people, right? People, human beings, make history. History is the aggregation of a bottom-up human behavior. And what is a human being but a ego, ordinary awareness, with this identification of oneself as a separate creature that needs to survive and achieve status and whatever, and the deeper obfuscated layers of the psyche who crave for greater meaning, who crave for a recognition of transcendence, a recognition of our true nature. And it's the conflict between the ego and the obfuscated psyche in each one of us that drives our behavior and therefore drives the whole of history, because history is the aggregation of our behavior as people. And I think there is a tremendous tension playing out there. On the side of the ego, there is a strong materialistic stigmergy. Stigmergy is when people reinforce each other's behavior because of the effects they leave on the environment out of their behavior. For instance, if I am a scientist, it's very beneficial for me to be a materialist. I'll progress more in my career, I'll have less problems, I'll attain to positions of status. If I'm a journalist, it's very beneficial that I err on the side of materialism because I will avoid all kinds of trouble and ridicule and pressure. If I am in the corporate world, materialism is conducive to consumerism, to the idea of generating increasing demand. So I may behave accordingly. So it's advantageous for the ego to behave according to materialist templates. And we will leave a footprint in the environment from our behavior that others will pick up on. And again, behave according to that. So you reinforce each other's pathological, neurotic, materialist behavior, leading to a nexus in our history where we are about to destroy ourselves. Not the planet. The planet will recover. We may have a nuclear war tomorrow. In a million years, we have forests and animals again. But we will destroy ourselves. We are very close to that threshold. And because of the implications of the materialist metaphysics, we also deny the other part of our psyche, the bigger, obfuscated, deepest part, by denying all true meaning to existence. And then you have the tension, because our obfuscated psyche is desperate to find a connection with transcendence and our true nature again, which expresses itself in the form of crazy myths out there that are taken to be literally true. You see that on the fringes of the culture. I don't want to name many names here, but there's a lot of craziness and absurdity and lack of reason out there. Religious fundamentalism is one aspect of this manifestation. It's the obfuscated psyche trying to hold on to something literal, absurd, but literal, which gives it some meaning back, some recognition of transcendence back again. And this tension is building up. It's not going anywhere. It will come to a point where it cannot be maintained. It's like continental plates pressing on each other. At some point, you have an earthquake, right? At some point, it will crack and it will shake. And we may not be too far away from that. Which way it will go, I don't know. How painful it will be, I don't know. But that the current status quo can go on forever is absurd. It cannot go, not even for another 100 years, maybe not even for another 50. I don't know how long. But on a historical perspective, we are on the brink of something quite significant.
Well, I guess we'll find out soon enough, won't we? Bernardo, today we've been talking about your latest book. Once again, it's Brief Peaks Beyond, Critical Essays on Metaphysics, Neuroscience, Free Will, Skepticism, and Culture. That's available everywhere, as are your other books, as far as I understand it. Tell folks about your website or websites and anything else you'd like to share.
I have a website, bernardocastrup.com. Castrup is K-A-S-T-R-U-P. There are links to all my online presence there, lots of free essays, free material. I have a YouTube channel, Bernardo Castrup, lots of videos there as well. Some debates I've had with materialists. There is a popular debate I've had with Leonard Mlodinow, Michael Shermer, and other people as well. There are summaries of my views in the form of videos as well. I have a Twitter account, at Bernardo Castrup, a Facebook page, Bernardo Castrup as well. A lot of free material out there. Of course, the books ultimately are the best way to get acquainted with my ideas. They require the opportunity that only a book offers to create a system and to tackle every part of the argument and every counter argument that usually comes up. Everything else is sort of more fragmented. But as an overview, there's a lot of free material out there.
Wonderful. Well, Bernardo, thank you so much for joining us once again on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Thanks for having me. It was fun, just like previous time. I hope to come back again at some point.
Well, folks, that's it for another week. As ever, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, check out the website, which is LegalizeFreedom.com. That's Legalize-Freedom.com, where you'll find an archive of programs offering alternative views on a wide range of topics, including politics and economics, energy and environment, culture, spirituality, history, and the nature of reality. You can also browse and buy a range of publications from our guests, and if you're feeling generous, make a donation to help keep the site up and running. Based on current audience numbers, if everyone who tuned in donated just 5 pence per show, that's about 8 cents US, this could become a full-time, fully funded operation, offering more and more often. During October 2014, over 50,000 of you streamed or downloaded at least one show. Total donations were 7 UK pounds, which currently converts to about $11 US. Whether you listen, donate, or do both, I greatly appreciate your support. Until next time, I'm Greg Moffat, and you've been listening to LegalizeFreedom.com.